It's Tuesday, February 11, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. I'm gay. That was the short announcement made by defensive lineman Michael Sam to his fellow players in a preseason meeting at the University of Missouri, of course, the University of Missouri's football team. And as Sam said, quote, "I looked in their eyes and they just started shaking their heads, like finally he came out." In other words, his teammates knew he was gay before he announced it. But so does the whole world, because on Sunday, Michael Sam, who is anticipating being a draft pick in the upcoming NFL draft, announced to the entire world that he is gay, making much the same announcement, but this time in the context of an interview with the New York Times. Explaining the paper's understanding of the significance of this announcement, John Branch reported that with this announcement, Michael Sam, quote, "set himself on a path to become the first publicly gay player in the National Football League," end quote. Later, Mr. Branch said this, quote, "Now Mr. Sam enters in an uncharted area of the sports landscape. He is making his public declaration before he is drafted, to the potential detriment to his professional career. And he is doing so as he prepares to enter a league with an overtly macho culture where controversies over homophobia have attracted recent attention," end quote. The only correction that I would make in terms of that announcement or analysis is the fact that Mr. Branch writes that in making this announcement, Michael Sam may actually hurt his professional career. To the contrary, the evidence is that he would help his personal career in terms of this announcement. And that is an interesting tale in and of itself. We need to note that the moral revolution on the issue of sexuality, and that means homosexuality specifically, is a moral revolution that does not shift a moral judgment from negative to neutral. It shifts the moral judgment from negative to neutral to positive. That's why the headlines having to do with Michael Sam's announcement have made this point emphatically clear. Writing for USA Today, columnist Mike Foss suggests that Michael Sam's announcement means that he is now on par with Jackie Robinson and Rosa Parks. Again, this is not a shift from negative moral judgment to neutral judgment, or no judgment at all. It is a shift all the way from negative moral judgment, which was almost universal in American culture as recently as 10 years ago, to a positive moral judgment. That's why when we speak of a moral revolution, we're not talking of a mere moral or cultural shift. We're talking about an absolute reversal. Christians trying to understand the meaning of this have to come to terms with the fact that we're not talking about a moral redirection. We're talking about nothing less than a moral revolution, a moral reversal. That's what the situation of Michael Sam tells us about when we look at the announcement that he made on Sunday and then look at the response to that announcement in terms of the national and international media. Staying just with the New York Times for the moment, columnist Juliet McCour in the same edition of the paper declares, quote, "Enough of the slow-moving, inch-by-inch steps toward making gay athletes a public part of the fabric of professional sports, as they should be. No more stone-by-stone dismantling of a wall of discrimination by players who announce they are gay only after they have retired from competing in the big leagues. There is," she writes, "no better moment than now to plow ahead and topple that wall with a bulldozer. And what a relief that Michael Sam, an All-American defensive end from Missouri, is in the driver's seat, bravely heading full speed ahead," end quote. Just think about the language that is used there. It is language of moral instruction. In this case, Juliet McCour is writing to her readers, instructing them that they should not only accept this decision and announcement, they should not only hope that Michael Sam will be drafted in terms of an NFL team, but they should join in the public celebration of this. Not that a very gifted and dedicated athlete is about to be drafted, but that an openly gay athlete is about to be drafted, and it is the openly gay aspect of the story that we are to celebrate. After tracing the moral change toward the acceptance of homosexuality in the larger society, Juliet McCour then writes, quote, "Now change is about to come to the NFL, the behemoth of the American sports landscape. It was inevitable, but the league now finds itself in a difficult and potentially awkward predicament. Its identity has been built on machismo and violence. It is a league rich with alpha males bursting with muscles who unapologetically smash into one another to the delight of millions of fans." Initially, she writes, "it may be hard for many viewers and some football players to see Sam, who has announced publicly that he is gay, as another hard-nosed, tough guy on his team's defense. But I suspect he will change their perception if a team gives him a chance," end quote. As if preparing for this announcement, last year the National Football League sent to its teams an announced policy that prohibits any kind of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. In all likelihood, Michael Sam will be drafted just about where it was expected he would be drafted even before the announcement. It's unlikely that this announcement will help him a great deal, but it's almost a sure thing that it will not harm him. But what we should note from a Christian worldview perspective is what is being demanded of us. Not merely the acknowledgement that the announcement has been made. Not only the affirmation that it shouldn't matter in terms of Michael Sam's hiring. I'm quite confident most Americans would agree with that. What is being demanded of us, though, goes far beyond those acknowledgments. It goes to the fact that what is being demanded of us is the celebration of this man's homosexuality. That is, we should note, something that Christians, based upon the authority of Scripture and obedient to that Scripture, simply cannot do. It is extremely revealing that in February of 2014, that is actually what's being demanded of us. Even a matter of just a few years ago, that would have seemed inconceivable. But that's the point of this moral reversal, of the revolution in morals we are now experiencing. Its speed is unprecedented. Its breadth is almost incalculable. And its forms are now coming in announcements such as this, and in the demand for celebration that now inevitably follows. A very strange story has dominated many of the airwaves and the newspaper pages just in the matter of the last several days. It has to do with the killing of a giraffe in a Copenhagen zoo and in the controversy that followed that action. As was reported in the Associated Press, quote, saying it needed to prevent inbreeding, the Copenhagen Zoo killed a 2-year-old giraffe Sunday and fed its remains to lions as visitors watched. The officials ignored a petition signed by thousands and offers from other zoos and a private individual to save the animal. In this case, the animal was a 2-year-old giraffe, a healthy male named Marius, and the animal was put down on Sunday using a bolt pistol instead of lethal injection so that the meat could be consumed safely by predators. Tobias Stenbeck Bro, the spokesman for the zoo, said that visitors, including children, were then invited to watch while the giraffe was skinned, an autopsy was performed, and then the carcass was fed to the lions. And now, as seems to be so often the case, people around the world found themselves talking about something that would have been inconceivable had they thought about it just the day before. Reporting for the New York Times, Nelson D. Schwartz gives a fuller explanation of what was going on here. He writes, administrators said they had decided to kill Marius, the giraffe, who was in good health because his genes were well represented among the captive giraffe population in European zoos. But that explanation did not satisfy animal rights activists who had mounted a furious last-minute campaign to save him. Perhaps the most interesting aspect of the story is the fact that most people, even those who visit zoos, are unaware of the massive worldview shift that has taken place in the world of zoos, especially zoos in more liberal cultures such as that of Denmark. The Copenhagen Zoo follows the kind of protocols that have been developed in order to try to keep a breeding population of specific animals, in this case of giraffes. Poor Marius, this 2-year-old male, simply had genes that were already represented in terms of the gene pool of the population. They did not want him to breed. They didn't want him to take up space and resources that could be allocated to an animal that had more fortuitous genes for their purposes. And this is the part that really sticks in the heart of many people. They didn't want the animal to live if the animal wasn't living within their protocols or in a sister institution that followed the same rules. In other words, the Copenhagen Zoo was adamant that the animal could not live elsewhere under different custody. Because, as odd as this may seem to most people in the world, the view of the zoo is that the animal is better off dead than not being under their care. If the animal received some care, even care that would be recognized by most people as adequate, if it didn't follow their protocols, the animal simply had to die. And that's the twisted logic of this zoo. Now, the logic may actually fit a zoological model. In reality, the zoo may have done what was justified, but the way it did it was hardly justified, and that's why this is now a matter of international news. Here you had a zoo that shot an animal that was already beloved by the public, had already been named by the public, and then they shot the animal in such a way that it was seen in public. They then performed a public autopsy and then butchered the animal, and then, having skinned the animal, they fed most of its carcass to predators, who were then openly witnessed by all present in the zoo, eating and devouring the beloved giraffe. The weird worldview of the Copenhagen Zoo's leadership was demonstrated in a statement made to the Associated Press by Tobias Stenbeck Bro, the spokesman for the zoo. He said, quote, I'm actually proud because I think we have given children a huge understanding of the anatomy of a giraffe that they wouldn't have had from watching a giraffe in a photo, end quote. Well, Mr. Stenbeck Bro, they certainly would not have had that knowledge by means of a photograph, or for that matter, a video from a zoo. But they now have that knowledge from you, because you butchered the animal right in front of their eyes and then fed the remains of the animal to the lions. The scientific director of the Copenhagen Zoo, Bing Holst, said this, quote, "I know the giraffe is a nice-looking animal, but I don't think there would have been such an outrage if it had been an antelope, and I don't think anyone would have lifted an eyebrow if it was a pig," end quote. Well, that's exactly right, but that gets to an issue of worldview significance. Here you have zoos who present the animals in terms of their observation by the public, and the zoos have to be aware of the fact that certain animals draw a certain attention, especially from children. And those animals become anthropomorphized. That's something that comes quite naturally to us. That's why Disney movies and other animated animals have so much interest to children, and for that matter, to many of their parents as well. Had this been done outside of the public eye, it would hardly have led to this kind of controversy. But this zoo actually butchered the animal right in public and fed it to the lions, supposedly doing children a favor by giving them, you heard the announcement made by the spokesman, an education in the anatomy of a giraffe they otherwise would never have received. Mr. Holtz also told the media, quote, "A giraffe is not a pet. It's not like a dog or cat that becomes part of the family. It is a wild animal," end quote. But the disingenuous angle on that statement is the fact that zoos, including the Copenhagen Zoo, use those animals of greatest interest to people, and in particular, of greatest interest to children, in order to draw crowds who buy tickets and offer the financial support that makes the zoo possible. It's hard to imagine, quite frankly, that a zoo in the United States would do anything like this. But the international furor points to something else we should note. There has been a tidal wave of opposition and outrage in response to this killing of a giraffe. Where is the outrage over the murder by the millions of unborn babies in the womb? Where is the outrage about the proposed legalization of euthanasia for children, after all, in the nation of Belgium? Here is something for Christians to think about. Our outrage tells us a great deal about ourselves. The selectivity of our outrage makes very clear the selectivity of our moral judgment. That's the real lesson from this controversy from Denmark. Shifting back to the United States, a very important article on the issue of the United Methodist Church is offered in the Associated Press by reporter Rachel Zoll. She writes in a quote, "The dispute among United Methodists over recognition of same-sex couples has lapsed into a doctrinal Donnybrook, pitting clergy who are presiding at gay weddings in defiance of church law against proponents of traditional marriage who are trying to stop them," end quote. Zoll goes on to explain what we know well by now in terms of recent events within the United Methodist Church. Since the year 2011, Methodist advocates, those pushing for the performing of same-sex marriages within the church, have been recruiting clergy and ministers to officiate at same-sex ceremonies. Doing so, we must note, in clear violation of church policies. Those policies actually have the force of church law as codified in the United Methodist Church's Book of Discipline. You'll recall that we discussed on the briefing several months ago the fact that a Pennsylvania United Methodist pastor by the name of Frank Schaefer had been found guilty of violating the law of the church. He refused to come under the discipline of the church after he had performed the same-sex marriage ceremony for his own son, and he has now become a symbolic character, as various jurisdictions of the church have offered him ministerial roles even after he was tried and convicted and defrocked. On the other hand, the opponents of same-sex marriage have organized as well, and there is a very clear impetus on the part of those who want to defend the discipline and the teaching of the church, because the official documents of the church are in no way confusing on the issue. They are abundantly clear. Same-sex marriages are not permissible. Openly gay clergy are not permissible. But in various jurisdictions of the church, both of these things are now happening. What makes this story of particular interest is the fact that the United Methodist Church has been, for the greater part of the last century, considered to be comfortably within the world of mainline liberal Protestantism. But even as the churches of mainline Protestantism have been in numerical decline and losing not only their numbers but their influence, they have, for the most part, accommodated themselves to the normalization of homosexuality. That is, except for the United Methodist Church. It's the outlier in liberal Protestantism. And, for that matter, as it turns out, the United Methodist Church, unlike those other churches and denominations, is probably becoming less liberal and not more liberal. And those who are pushing for the normalization of homosexuality may actually have lit the fuse that leads to a revolution in a more conservative direction within the United Methodist Church. They have lit this fuse by their open defiance of church doctrine and by their open advocacy for the subversion of the church's official teaching. And, as Rachel Zoll reports in this story for the Associated Press, this has led to a pushback that is led not only by international churches that have been joining the United Methodist Church, and those largely from the Global South represent a more conservative position, but also by something that is even less expected. And that is that the United Methodist Church is actually, to use the words of one of its own church historians, becoming more of a red state church and less of a blue state church. That statement was made by David Steinmetz, an emeritus professor at Duke University's Divinity School, who said, and I quote, "The church is now more, quote, red statey than it ever was," end quote. Professor Steinmetz, a very insightful church historian, also gets right to the point when he says this, quote, "The church is already partly in schism. You've got bishops not obeying the law of the church. You have pastors not obeying the law of the church. How long can they live with two mindsets? I just don't know," end quote. The progressive embrace of homosexuality and the normalization of homosexual marriage, homosexual behaviors, and homosexual clergy within mainline Protestantism is well summarized by Rachel Zoll when she writes, "The situation for United Methodists stands out because their fellow mainline Protestants have moved toward accepting gay relationships. The United Church of Christ began ordaining people with same-sex partners in the 1970s, and by 2005 had endorsed gay marriage. In 2003, the Episcopal Church elected the first bishop living openly with a same-sex partner, Bishop Gene Robinson. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and the Presbyterian Church USA have both struck down barriers to ordaining gays and lesbians." That's indeed a pretty good summary of the situation in mainline Protestantism on this issue. But what we need to note, especially of importance to Christians thinking from a Christian worldview, is the fact that the underlying issue is always irreducibly the authority of Scripture. Long before these churches, as documented in Zoll's article, began to embrace and normalize homosexuality, they long before that had abandoned the authority of Scripture, its inerrancy, its inspiration, its total authority in every dimension of life. And what makes the United Methodist Church the outlier is that it has resisted the acceptance of homosexuality. But at the end of the day, we need to note, even before the United Methodist Church decisively deals with this issue, that the underlying issue in that church, as in all the others, will be the authority of Scripture. The authority of the church's book of discipline simply will not hold back this moral revolution. The only thing sustainable, the only authority that is immovable on this issue, is Holy Scripture. If the United Methodist Church binds itself to the authority of Scripture, it will be bound to the rules now found in its book of discipline. If it tries to hold back this tide merely by the authority of the book of discipline standing on its own, the effort will fail, the discipline will be revised, and the rules will change. As we look to the weekend, remember my new podcast, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Just give us your call. We want your question in your voice. Call 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. You can find the last couple of weeks archived at albertmuller.com, along with the release of my new Thinking in Public broadcast, my interview with historian George Marsden on the end of the American Enlightenment. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmuller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmuller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Austin, Texas, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.